The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network. www.theflypod.com.
FlyPod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today we have the author of The Woman in Cabin 10. Well, that was her last book. She's got a brand new one called The Death of Mrs. Westaway, and that's Ruth Ware, New York Times bestselling author, and also bestselling author where you're from, and that's the UK.
Yeah, Great Britain, that's me.
Yeah, well, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's very exciting to be here.
All right, well, you know, let's look a little bit at the death of Mrs. Westaway. Here we have this lady who is passed away, and probably the lawyer has written letters to people to gather them for, well, perhaps some money and other things that's available. Is that correct?
That is correct. So having written 3 books about women who kind of stumble into extraordinary events through no fault of their own, I guess, I decided with my 4th that I wanted to do something a little bit different. I wanted to write about someone who brings the events of the novel down upon themselves. So my main character, Harriet, or Hal, she's young, she's lost her mum, she's out of touch with all of her friends, and she's in debt to a loan shark. And then one day she receives the kind of, you know, the letter that we all daydream about from a lawyer saying that she's inherited a substantial sum of money from her grandmother, who is the Mrs. Westaway of the title. But there is one problem, which is that Hal's grandmother died more than 20 years ago, and the woman in the letter is a complete stranger to her. But Hal knows that she has certain skills which mean that she could potentially claim the money anyway. So, yeah, that's what she sets out to do. She travels down to the funeral and basically decides to defraud the family out of their inheritance.
You know, and that sounds like a really, really cool story, and building that story around this character. And I'm sure she has a lot of trials and tribulations through this, doesn't she?
She does. I mean, it was really fun. So when I started writing the book, I knew that I wanted to write about someone who kind of who basically commits a crime. And I started thinking about all the books that I love with these kind of fantastic anti-heroes and heroines, you know, books like The Talented Mr. Ripley, where Tom Ripley is this kind of con man, you know, he's sort of psychopathic, really. And I thought, that is the kind of character I want to write. I want to write someone very morally ambiguous, who's out for themselves. Hal was never going to be a Tom Ripley, because I don't think I could write someone quite as psychopathic as Tom. But I wanted her to be someone definitely kind of morally and ethically very grey. But kind of in spite of myself, she turned out not to be that person. She was pretty much determined from page one that she wasn't going to be that person. So I ended up giving her some mitigating circumstances. I took away her family. I took away her friends. I put her in debt to this loan shark who is intimating that he is going to collect on his debt fairly soon. And I just basically made her life as difficult as possible. And I also, kind of in spite of myself, found myself giving her a code of ethics. So that was the most interesting part of the book for me, really, was watching how all books are kind of about someone who wants something and they have something preventing them from getting it. And in Hal's case, what she wants is security, which for her means money. And the person who's preventing her from getting it is herself. It's her own kind of moral code, means that she really struggles to do the, you know, what she set out to do. So that was fun to write.
You know, and I think people know people like that. If they were a little more honest, a little more forthgiving in a sense, they would probably make more. they would make more of their life also if they were just to go the opposite fork in the road, I guess.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah. And this is, you know, the start of the book is a complete fork in the road for Hal. She has two potential things she can do, and she picks the one that is in a way more contrary to her nature, and in doing so she kind of sets off this whole domino effect of events which turns out to be much stranger and more complicated and darker than she could ever have imagined. And she knows she's getting herself into a difficult situation when she goes down to claim this inheritance, but she has no idea how very difficult it is going to be.
Ruth, now, you know, with the death of Mrs. Westaway, you have this loan shark in here. You're writing this, well it's a book from the UK, basically.
Yeah.
So what is your loan shark like? Is your loan shark different than maybe somebody here in the States, or are they pretty much all the same?
I don't know, really, because, I mean, I think this is the thing. I'm a very English writer, and people often, you know, they often ask me if I'm going to set my book somewhere different, or, yeah, maybe move them to the States. But the truth is, I don't know enough about that kind of culture from the inside, what it's like to live there. So I actually must confess, I don't really know what UK loan sharks are like, because I've never been, fortunately, the only people I'm in debt to is the bank, who are much more polite.
Well, I don't know, they could be loan sharks too, I think.
The other thing is that you never actually see this guy, because I think in some ways that makes someone more scary. So he's writing Hal menacing notes, and he sends his minion in to kind of to not to beat her up exactly, but to definitely give her a shock. So, yeah, he's this kind of shadowy figure in the background who's more of a sort of theoretical threat.
Yeah, and I like the use of the word shadowy, because it's almost like a horror show where you know that they're out there, but you don't really know what you know.
Yeah.
It could be anybody.
Actually, I think kind of shadowy and kind of gothic and dark were the sort of, they were the kind of feelings that I was trying to evoke when I was writing this book. And in some ways, it's a more old-fashioned book than my first three. When I bought out my first book, In a Dark, Dark Wood, very early on, people started making comparisons to Agatha Christie in the reviews, which for me was a huge compliment, because I love Christie and I love classic crime. And I wrote kind of two books with that in the back of my mind. But I think The Death of Mrs. Westaway was a kind of conscious tribute from me to another writer who I enormously admire, and who has hugely different strengths to Christie, but I think is equally good. Daphne du Maurier, who wrote Rebecca, which was made into the very famous film, and My Cousin Rachel, which was recently filmed with Rachel Weisz. And just her writing is fantastic. You know, the thing about Agatha Christie is she does amazing plots, and her kind of the way she sets up the crimes and her sort of the kind of the puzzle elements of her book is just, you know, they're so good. You get to the end of a Christie and all of the pieces click into place, and it's hugely satisfying. But her strength isn't really characterization. You know, that's not true for all of her books, but certainly for some of them, you know, you have the sense that these are kind of not quite cardboard cutouts, but, you know, that their purpose is to fulfill their role in the plot rather than to be themselves. And I don't think that's true of my books. For me, I like to get much more immersed into character and sort of walk in people's shoes a bit more. And Daphne du Maurier does that par excellence. I mean, her books are just, you know, they immerse you into the psychology and the paranoia and the fears of her main characters in a way that I hugely admire.
Ruth, how difficult is it to break into the United States with a book?
I think I was hugely lucky, because my first book, In a Dark, Dark Wood, was pretty much instantly a New York Times bestseller, which was something that I had never expected. Yeah, when I was writing it, for anyone who hasn't read it, it's about a murder that occurs on a hen party or a bachelorette. And I think when I wrote it, I was sort of thinking it was this weird little British book about a very British institution. And, you know, we do lots of odd little kind of quirks on a hen party, which doesn't seem to happen anywhere else in the world. Like, we make the bride wear L plates, learner plates. When someone's learning to drive on a car, they have to have like a, you know, a big red L on the car to show that they're a new driver and that you might want to be a bit careful around them. And for some reason, brides always have to wear those, I guess because they're learning to be a wife, which is a bit sexist. But, you know, there were all these kind of aspects that I thought, I don't know. Will anyone outside of my friends and maybe my mother-in-law buy this book? Probably not. So it was an enormous surprise to me that it even sold to a publisher in the States, let alone that so many people over here wanted to buy it. And I'm still just, yeah, amazed and kind of pinching myself. But it's been fantastic. And to kind of find my little, you know, cast of weird, prickly, quirky characters being enjoyed by so many people in so many places that I've, you know, never had the chance to go is just amazing.
Well, you know, with a party before you get married, and of course, probably a bachelorette party is what they would be called, they usually go to the bars and everything like that. Not necessarily so in Europe or England. And let me get this straight. Do they wear a plate on them or on their car?
No, on them, like literally hung around their necks with a piece of string. And it's kind of themed, you know, you can get like themed banners and stuff like that and sashes. I mean, there's for sure there's a lot of drinking goes on in the UK as well. I grew up in Brighton, which is like a seaside resort on the south coast of the UK. And for some reason, I'm not sure why, it's the basically the hen party capital of the South. So it's where everybody goes to go clubbing and to, you know, they wear themed outfits. And if you go out to the bars on a Saturday night, you can see these kind of gangs of women dressed up as, you know, all Sherlock Holmeses or all, you know, the themes they come up with are amazing. And you get stag parties too as well. But I think you're right. You know, that's the thing. It is a universal thing to have a celebration before you get married. And one of the joys of publishing the book has been finding out about all the weird kind of traditions all over the rest of the world. Like in France, that their word for a hen party is the enterrement de la vie d'une jeune fille, which means your burial of your life as a young girl, which is just the creepiest. And in Sweden, they literally kidnap the bride. The bride has no idea when it's going to be. Her friends turn up at her work, having cleared it with her boss first, usually, and literally drag her off. So.
And then I guess the crying starts after you're married.
Hopefully not.
And, you know, every family has its secrets. Some are worth killing for. That's what you say in the, on the front of the book from Europe. I don't see that necessarily on the
on the American edition. Yeah. I know. Well, that's the thing. My books have always had really different presentations in the UK, which is where I'm from, versus in America. So that's the interesting thing, is that my books have always had very different covers in the UK, which is where I'm from, versus the United States. And so the cover for this book is no different, really. The UK and European cover is really brightly coloured, and it's quite commercial, I guess. It's got like a kind of spooky mansion, which is the house in the book, Trepassen House, and my main character walking towards it. And the American cover is completely different. It's a bit more, I don't know, a bit more literary in a way. It's black and white. It's very atmospheric.
Do you know why that is?
I guess each publisher is just appealing to a different market. I don't know, maybe it's because, I guess when we publish in the UK, when we publish books in translation, like we read a lot of Scandinavian noir, because they're a bit different and a bit unfamiliar, they automatically kind of seem a bit more literary in a way. Like what's familiar to you always feels kind of easier and sort of more accessible. So maybe it's a way of signaling like I'm a bit sort of a bit different. I don't know.
Well, with your brand new book, Ruth, The Death of Mrs. Westaway, how much research did you have to do, if any, on this?
Well, normally my research is kind of into the mechanics of the plot and the sort of the policing and the my first book, the woman in it had a head injury, so I was researching how that would go, like how would it affect her memory and stuff. But this book was very different. So I talked a little bit earlier about how I wanted to make my main character set out to commit a crime, basically, and to precipitate the events of the novel through that. So I decided that I wanted to give her a profession where she would have the tools to kind of do that. I wanted to equip her to deceive people. So I had a think, and I decided I was going to make her a tarot reader, but a cynical tarot reader. So Hal doesn't believe in the power of the cards. She uses her skills as a cold reader to basically tell people what she thinks they want to hear. And for anyone listening who doesn't know the term cold reader, it's basically it's a set of techniques used by fake mediums and fake psychics and con artists as well to read people, to get information from them without asking them necessarily any questions or without doing any research, just by making assumptions based on their, you know, their clothes, their demeanor, their age, and how they react to you in conversation. You know, you can ask them certain questions and get much more information than people realize they're giving. So my character, Hal, has been doing that all of her life. And that's what enables her to go down to a strange woman's funeral and pretend to be one of her relatives.
Yeah, because, you know, when I saw Cold Reader, I didn't really understand what that meant.
Yeah. So I had to do a lot of research into the actual techniques used by kind of, you know, fake mediums and stuff as part of the research for the book, which was hugely fun, if slightly worrying. But also, I knew nothing about tarot when I started writing the book. I'd seen the pictures of the cards and I found them very beautiful, but I didn't know how to conduct a reading or what the individual cards meant. So I bought a bunch of books on cold reading, and I also bought a load on tarot reading. And I went into the tarot books kind of completely skeptical, really. I'm not a very superstitious person. I don't really believe in the occult. So I went into it kind of prepared to find it a load of old cobblers, really. But the more I researched it and the more I found out how to conduct readings, and I went and had my cards read by a professional reader, the more respect I had for tarot, actually, because ultimately the cards in tarot are really representing just the different forces that we all of us have acting on our lives. You know, the desire for security, the demands of our profession, the pressures of family, heart versus head, you know, all of those different things that we all have to consider every time we make a decision. And everybody who comes to a tarot reading has a question or a dilemma. You know, you don't normally go to get your cards read without having some sort of question in the back of your mind. And really, all a good tarot reader is doing is offering you different ways to consider that question and asking you to have a think about all the different pressures that are coming to bear and why you're acting in the way that you are and whether you could think about things in a different way. I don't think most tarot readers really sort of pretend to know the future. In fact, most guides will say very firmly that that's not what it's about. It's about figuring out the energies that you've brought with you to the reading. And I really came out of it with a huge respect for tarot and tarot readers, because I concluded in the end that anything that kind of encourages people to think more deeply about what motivates them and what they want out of life and to reflect more carefully on their decisions and their actions is probably a really positive force.
So they're more or less psychics, if you will. Your belief, your personal belief, I guess, on psychics themselves.
Psychics, I'm completely skeptical about, really. And when I first started out, I considered making Hal a psychic, but I think for me, it would have required her to be, because she's a skeptical person, it would have required her to be more deliberately deceptive than I wanted her to be. And there's a pivotal scene at the beginning of the novel where Hal's doing a tarot reading for someone. It's a woman. And she, during the course of the reading, she stumbles on something intensely personal that the woman has been concealing from her. Almost accidentally, it's based on her sort of instincts about the woman. But the woman believes it's a genuine psychic insight and is very shaken by it. And she ends up running out of the reading and she leaves Hal a fee. And when Hal comes to count the money, she realizes that the woman's given her far too much. He's given her 4 or 5 times her normal fee. So she runs after her to try and give the money back. But it's night, it's raining, the woman has disappeared. And in spite of the fact that she's in debt, in spite of the fact that this loan shark is after her, Hal finds she can't accept that money. So she ends up donating it to a charity donation box. And that was one of the first scenes that I wrote. And it kind of surprised me because I had been intending to make her a more cynical person. And at that point, I realized that I was dealing with a character who had a really strong code of ethics. And I think for me to make her a fraudulent medium would have just, it just wouldn't have fitted with the character who started talking to me.
You know, talking about the character talking to you, I know a lot of authors that as they're writing their character, their protagonist or whoever, they all of a sudden now start to take on that persona and they may go to the grocery store and now all of a sudden you're Hal. What would Hal do?
Oh, that's so funny.
That doesn't happen to you, I guess.
No, I mean, all of my characters are me to some extent, not just the main characters, but the minor ones as well, because I think the process of creating a character is, well, for me, I can't speak for all authors, but, you know, you take a little bit from here, a little bit from there, you take, you know, your friend's weird little habit or, you know, the strange dynamic of that person that you saw in the supermarket and you stitch them together. But what makes that character come to life is the little bit of yourself that you put into them. And I don't think I couldn't create a character that where I couldn't imagine committing their actions. I think that's why I don't write kind of psychopath books, because there's no part of me that I could imagine acting in that way. And if I can't in my imagination walk in the shoes of a character, I can't convincingly write them. But I don't think so. I guess, you know, to that extent, I am all of my characters all the time, but I don't think I've ever kind of taken on their persona. What I do find, and I kind of deliberately have to guard against this, but if I'm writing, like, say I'm writing a very tense argumentative scene or something like that, and everybody's very angry and being very unreasonable, if I just kind of shut my computer down and go straight down to my family, I find that I'm angry and I sort of come down feeling how unreasonable everybody is, and, you know, they just all need to, and I have to kind of make a conscious effort to say, no, that was that. This is, you know, let's just take a minute and kind of decompress almost.
So I guess with after this interview, I don't have to worry about me like being under your porch buried 6 feet down or anything. So I hope it's a good interview so far. But anyway, you know, a lot of authors also, they do book clubs, and book clubs will either call or they'll go depending on where they are. What is a book club like in the UK? I don't know if you've ever done any here, if you know maybe if there's any difference.
Over here, I've never done one in the States actually in person. I've done a few Skype ones, but the problem for me, sadly, is the time difference, because book clubs typically meet kind of in the evening, sort of 7 or 8 o'clock. And of course, for me, that's gone midnight and I'm safely in bed. And if I was awake, I don't think my insights would be very helpful to anybody. I'd just sit there yawning. I've done a number of book clubs in the UK. And in fact, I used to be a member of a book club. There's typically quite a lot of wine involved, a lot of alcohol. From my own experience of being a book club attendee rather than a writer, we spent more time talking about ourselves and our families and, you know, shooting the breeze than we did about the book. That was always the excuse to be there. I think when the author's there, people tend to keep on topic a little bit more. But what's always so fascinating about a book club is you realise that no two people read the same book. You know, that I feel like with a movie, you're given much more information. You know, the version that you watch is much more a standard kind of version. But with a book, and you have to make your peace with this as an author, it's a real kind of collaboration between you and the reader. You know, what they bring to the character in terms of their own assumptions and the voices that they hear in their heads and the pictures that they see in their heads is as important as what you yourself put on the page. And that can be frustrating sometimes if people interpret your character in a way that you never meant, but in other ways it can be absolutely wonderful because you get insights into the character that you never spotted or intended, and they can be wonderful.
So what's next? You've got The Death of Mrs. Westaway out. What's next for Ruth Ware?
Well, I'm writing book five, so my publishers have me on a book a year contract, so I've promised to give them another book, and I've started it, but normally by this time in the year, I would have almost finished it. Normally, I hand my books in the summer, but because I've been traveling, I've been touring in the States, I've been going all around Europe, I haven't been spending as much time at the desk as normal. So I'm behind on this one, which means I can't really talk about it because it's too early days and I don't want to jinx myself. Having said I'm not a superstitious person, I've just totally outed myself. Really superstitious when it comes to my writing.
All right, so if I want more information about The Death of Mrs. Westaway, if I want more information on the other four books or so that you've written, do you have a website that I could go to?
I do have a website, yeah. It's www.ruthware.com, and there's info about all my books on there, and I also have a Reader's Club where people can sign up for newsletters and access a secret page with extra information about the books that's not available to everyone else.
Ooh, I missed the secret page. Maybe I was, maybe I just couldn't get into that.
Well, it's a secret.
Yes, so. It is. Okay. Well, I know now. Well, anyway, this is The Death of Mrs. Westaway, the brand new book by Ruth Ware. I tell you what, I think that you're going to fall in love with Hal. You're going to wish maybe that she was maybe a little different, but you're going to find out about her challenges, and it's going to keep you on the edge of your seat. Ruth, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Cover to Cover. I'm your host, Mark DeWitt, with Ruth Ware, author of her new book, The Death of Mrs. Westaway.
To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.